History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And you hear me remind you every week that they don't have to go untold if we're willing to intervene, if we take the initiative to ask a few questions, investing time and attention into listening with the desire to understand. And you know, it's amazing how much depth we can add to our perspective. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve, of course, their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. But what we realize is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we can find inspiration in these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to honor two members of that generation today that longtime listeners may remember. But before we get to that, I just want to personally thank everybody who joined me in welcoming home 73 veterans from their honor flight to Washington, D.C. this past week. There are honor flight hubs in all the areas where this program airs. No matter what state you're listening in today, there is an honor flight near you. And if you haven't volunteered to help that effort yet, find out when the next flight full of heroes is coming home and be there to welcome them. It might just change your life. Fresno, California is where the event I'm referring to took place this past week. It happened to be the same day that Charlie Kirk was shot in Utah. That shocking development was on the consciousness of everyone in attendance, regardless of their beliefs. But seeing age 0 to 100, every ethnicity, every tax bracket, all corners of the political spectrum, every religious persuasion, a diverse crowd of over 1,000 demonstrate that unity is possible when we have something we can agree on was pretty powerful. We all agree our veterans deserve our gratitude, and maybe we can start from that shared appreciation and discover other ways to carve a path toward a more truly united States of America. Our 99-year-old World War II veteran friend Vern Schmidt was there fresh off a visit from General Patton's granddaughter Helen the day before. Vern's going to be signing copies of his new book at the next Central Valley Honor Flight homecoming there on October 15th. But a sentiment shared that night by 95-year-old Korean War veteran Sam Banuelos is where I'd like to start today. Sam spent nearly 2 years as a prisoner of war, and he told that crowd, "No one appreciates freedom more than those who have spent even 1 minute without it." Next week will be National Prisoner of War Missing in Action Day, another topic to investigate where you live and maybe attend an observance. This past week, in Fort Collins, Colorado, an ex-POW named Bill Powell finished his journey on Earth just 1 month shy of his 104th birthday. Like almost every World War II veteran we've had the privilege of meeting over the years, Bill had a very specific memory of December 7th, 1941.
I was in school at the time, Ohio Northern University, and we had walked out of the place where we were living and started to walk toward the university, and some of the guys said, "Hey, did you hear what happened?" And I said, "No." And so they went ahead and told us that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
No.
And when did you start thinking, you know, I might be involved in this war?
Well, I knew I was going to get involved because I was of that age and I was physically able, so I knew I would be somewhere in it.
And I've interviewed a few World War II vets over the years who have the unique distinction of serving while their fathers were serving. And your father was a World War I veteran who also served in World War II?
Yes, he served in World War II. He was an engineer in the vicinity of Ohio and Indiana with various service facilities that were being built there. So he spent his whole service life in Ohio and in Indiana.
It's a good way to do it. You were in a few more dangerous places, as it turned out, but that journey to becoming a pilot, I met a lot of guys who joined the Army Air Corps in World War II because they wanted to be pilots, but a lot of them ended up navigators, bombardiers, gunners. What made you believe you could rise to the top and get through all that and become a pilot?
Well, I felt that with the engineering facilities that I had, that I could probably at least get a chance to be in the Air Force someplace, and hopefully as a pilot.
Were there any moments along the way as you went from different stages of training that made you wonder if you were going to make it?
Oh, I think that was always a wonder when you come to a new station. You wonder, well, what are they going to have that I can qualify for, and what can I do? With the feeling that, I'm capable of doing whatever they want with me.
Well, I'm just guessing that before you ended up in the 461st Bomb Group, you probably got to fly a few different aircraft. What are some of the planes that you flew along the way?
Well, the PT something or other, which is a primary flight plane, and that was a single-engine biplane. Went to primary training, basic training, all the time those planes were getting bigger and bigger, and I qualified in every station for being a pilot after some test flights and so on and so forth. So I was accepted as a pilot.
Any hairy moments along the way, rough landings or unexpected turns?
No, I don't expect anything too much. Macon, Georgia, we had some bad weather a few times. That was about it.
How did you feel about this idea of going overseas? And did you know what you were getting into?
Well, that's the ultimate anticipation, that you will be assigned overseas. Can you get in where the action is?
The crew you ended up flying with, were you guys together in the States before you went overseas?
A few of us were.
What do you remember about that journey over to Europe?
After we finished flight training, we went up to New York. We flew from New York down to the Azores and then over to our assigned place in Italy. That's when we picked up the B-24. But we had some education in flying the B-24.
Well, and to go from New York across all that ocean, I hope you had a pretty good navigator, huh?
Well, we got there, so I guess we did.
And how many men were you responsible for? How many men on that plane?
I think we just had 10. A single flight crew was there together.
You remember your very first mission? What that was like?
We made a couple of missions over the Adriatic to some dockside facilities that had been set up by the Germans, mm-hmm. or by the Italians, anyhow. We made 3 flights, I think it was, to Le Havre, France. The Allies had landed in the Adriatic and moved on up the Rhone River and gotten as far north as just beyond Le Havre, and they had established or had captured a German airfield at that point and re-established it, and so we flew bombs and gas into that point. In other words, we just loaded up our planes as much as they could take in both bombs and gas, and delivered it to the French.
Most of us, especially today, I mean, America hasn't been flying B-24s for decades, so most of us will never know what it feels like to fly a B-24. Can you give us a taste of what it feels like to be in the cockpit and in control of that flying anvil, as some called it?
It was a good flying airplane, so there wasn't much to it except to always remember what you were doing, where you were going, and all the aspects of flying a 4-engine B-24.
And I know we're going to talk a lot about your 10th and final mission, but were there any moments in your first 9 missions that got your attention, that gave you a taste of what was to come or made you a little anxious?
Well, as near as I can remember, they were unopposed, outside of maybe a little anti-aircraft at some of the stations that we bombed. That was about it.
But the 10th mission, unfortunately, didn't go that way. October 4th, 1944. I'd just love to let you explain that day and what you remember about it as best you can.
The 10th mission was a mission up to Germany at Munich to bomb the marshaling yards. And then coming back from that, I had just turned over the controls to the co-pilot, who of course was sitting right next to me. Looked out the front window, and here come 2 500-pound bombs from above us. And they were American bombs. You could tell from stuff that had been loaded to us, the same thing. And the slight observation of a bomber of some type up there, probably a B-24. I was flying the right wing of the lead plane, and they hit the lead plane, both of them, with a tremendous explosion. And my co-pilot immediately slumped over, and I grabbed the controls again and started to assess the damage that we had. And I knew that we weren't going to get very far. So this was in Germany. And so on the way back, unfortunately, it had knocked out the front turret, and behind the turret was the workspace, paper-wise, for the bombardier and the navigator. We started on back, of course, and it had knocked out the outboard engine, which left us three engines, and then the inboard engine was also damaged. I eventually had to feather that, so we were riding on two engines. I thought, well, we've got to get back to southern Italy. We have to fly over the Alps on the way back. And the navigator couldn't get to his quarters because it had been bombed out along with the front turret. So what are we going to do? I don't think with two engines I might not make it over the Alps. And I know that there might be some ways around it, but the navigator doesn't have any maps to direct us. So I gave the order to bail out. We're just going to sacrifice the plane and bail out so that we don't get hurt any further. And I knew we were over Germany, so I just gave the order to bail out. And that's what happened. All 10 of us got out.
Even the co-pilot?
Oh, no, he was killed. A piece of shrapnel must have hit him. And I could see that he had lost somewhere from his left shoulder, complete left shoulder laid down. I suppose the arm was gone too. But I knew he was dead because he wasn't bleeding.
I know it's been more than 80 years and you've told the story a couple times, but you just described all of that really matter-of-factly. I'm thinking when you were a 20-something kid in charge of that airplane, this had to be a pretty chaotic scene. I mean, the plane in front of you blows up, shrapnel comes into your cockpit, blows up your nose, kills your co-pilot, and it sounds like if you hadn't stood up right before that, you would have been killed too. Is that right?
Yeah, I have no idea of what happened to him and how he got blown up like that, and I didn't suffer any damages, and nobody else on the plane suffered any damage that I knew of. So I just gave the order to bail out, and I knew that we were still over a portion of Germany. So we just had to wait and see what happened from that point.
We'll hear about what happened from there when we come back, honoring World War II bomber pilot and prisoner of war Bill Powell today after his passing at age 103. Another reminder to capture these stories before it's too late. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing.
growing.
Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode honoring two centenarians who just finished their journeys on Earth. We're going to honor Ray Lee before we're done, but let's continue with Bill Powell's story now. Originally from Ohio, he has a bridge named after him in Florida, but he spent his final years in Colorado. The last 80-plus years of his life were colored by the events of one specific day.
October 4th, 1944, when his 10th mission as a B-24 pilot with the 461st Bomb Group was interrupted by a tragic mishap. The lead plane in his formation was hit with two 500-pound bombs from above, dropped by another American bomber. The resulting explosion sent shrapnel through the nose of Bill's B-24, instantly killing his co-pilot. Bill had gotten up to stretch his legs just before that. I'm sure you've thought about it a time or two over the years. What's your real opinion? What do you think would have happened to you if you were still strapped in that left seat?
Nothing happened to me, fortunately. As far as shots were concerned and bombing was concerned, nothing happened to me, so I was able to get out as long as I could get my crew out. Just a freak accident anyhow. So we hadn't been subject to any anti-aircraft or any fighter. Of course, the German fighter facilities at that time were all concentrated on action from the invasion of France to the west.
So before that day, before that moment, had you ever thought about the possibility of becoming a prisoner of war?
No.
But you're bailing out of this airplane. You know you're behind enemy lines. What was that journey down to the ground like in that parachute?
That was it. Trying to think, well, what's going to happen now? When I hit the ground, if nobody's around, am I going to try to walk out of France? Or what's going to happen to me? So I wandered all the way down. And when I hit the ground, I turned around and got my parachute bundled up. And there stood a farmer with a gun on me. He doesn't speak English, and the only German words I could think of were the word for friend. I knew then that, of course, that he wasn't going to accept that. So he motioned for me to bundle up my parachute and then come ahead of me, and we walked up to a small village close by. He motioned me to go in the front door there, which I did. I walked into a room, the family room of this particular house, and there were likewise houses on either side of the street, just a small house, not big ones. And he motioned me to go in this one house, which I did. And when I walked in, here was the living room with enough seats on either side to be able to seat probably 10 women on it as a total. And when I walked in, I put the parachute down and they immediately jumped on it. They wanted that material that the parachute was made out of.
They wanted to make some dresses, huh?
Yeah, it was my first experience with the Germans.
And to this point, you don't know what happened to the rest of your crew or where they came down or what they were up to?
No. As far as I knew, everybody got out because I checked what I could see of the rest of the plane, which was all of it, and everybody was down. The tail gunner came out last. Everybody else had gone except me. And the tail gunner walked out, and I said, get down there. So he bailed out. And then when I first walked out of the cockpit with my chute, the radio man was standing there. Fortunately, we hadn't closed our bomb bay doors, so there was plenty of room to get out. He was standing there in front of the front bomb bay, right in front of me, and so he started to go, and then he stepped back, so I hit him and knocked him out. And to the best of my knowledge, he made it all right.
So you're in this family's home. How did they treat you?
Everybody was so interested in that parachute that they didn't pay any attention to me. And the German guard I had then made a motion toward the door or something, and a ranking German soldier came in. Well, he spoke English, I think, and he said, come this way. So I went with him. And right close to where this village was, I guess it was on the outskirts of the village, there was a German outpost, just an office-like thing. Mm-hmm. He took me in there, and I introduced myself to two other American pilots who were sitting there. One of them was a fighter pilot who had gotten shot down, and the other one was a B-25 bomber that had gotten shot down somewhere. But he had gotten shot down for making his second run of the day, a follow-up run. So he got shot down. Well, so there was three of us, and of course the German officers in there spoke English and said, we're taking you up to Frankfurt.
The infamous interrogation center?
Yeah, they said, there's an interrogation center there, which you we'll have to go through. They must have put us on a train right away. We hadn't had anything to eat. None of the three of us had had. So we started to complain about being hungry. So the train stopped and dropped us off, us three guys and a German guard. First thing they told us, they said, if you promise not to try to escape, we will leave you with your shoes and belts. And, of course, we promised that because we didn't know where we were, where we were going. So the train stopped, I guess, and dropped us off at some village on the way. So we managed to get a lunch. But the people that were already in there, this was a public restaurant in there, they scowled and stomped and probably cussed us out. Which we couldn't understand, but we understood that they had reason to. So when we finished that, we went out and got aboard another train and continued it on up to Frankfurt. They took us in there, provided us with some so-called living quarters. In other words, there was a room there with a bed and toilet facilities. We stayed in there probably overnight. The next day they called us in for questioning. I hadn't been in the unit very long, so I didn't know too much about squadron activities and so on and so forth. So I just told them I didn't know, I hadn't been there. And they kind of accepted that, told us to stand by. So just sat back and waited till, I think it was the next day. It might have been 2 days, or at least a day. Then they called a number of us out. It was surprising to me how many prisoners they had. And they put us aboard a train headed for Stalagluft 1, which was on Barth on the Baltic. And I assume that in normal times, it was probably a summer vacation spot for the Germans, because it's right on the Baltic.
But I know this wasn't going to be a vacation for you. And I've got to ask you, I've had a lot of people tell me with these German interrogators that not only did they often speak perfect English, but a lot of times they knew things about some of those captured airmen that they didn't even know about themselves. Did they have a file on you? Did they tell you anything that they knew about you?
Yes, I assume that they knew about me anyhow, because after they interrogated me, and I hadn't been there long enough to know very much about the squadron anyhow, we talked a little bit afterward, and I discovered that they knew more about the squadron than I did.
And what were the accommodations like at Stalag Luft 1?
They sent me down to their prison section and put me in barracks number 10, as near as I can remember. And that's what the prison camp was made up of, a series of buildings that were opened up inside just for prisoners. They had double bank cots in there to sleep on. I think I was the last one to be housed in that particular room in that barracks.
And I'm sure you had a nice cushy bed and plenty of comfortable blankets and a heater in the corner.
Well, we had straw mattresses. That was a mattress in the bunk. And they were double bunks. It was heated. The whole building was heated. In particular that room, you know, if you slept with your clothes on, it wasn't too bad.
Even in the worst winter that Europe had seen forever? Because, I mean, this is, you're not too far before the Battle of the Bulge was beginning. We've heard all those infamous stories. Did it get pretty cold that winter?
I don't recall that we suffered any particular disadvantage from it. Being so fully closed 24 hours a day was probably all right.
How about the food?
The food was occasional. No, I don't mean occasionally in an amount. There was enough amount, but it was hard to tell sometimes exactly what it was. But then the German people were suffering the same thing. We occasionally got Red Cross parcels. When we got Red Cross parcels, we would combine all of those in the room, because by that time we didn't go to the mess hall. In fact, as I think the mess hall had been burned down, we would combine those parcels. Although we didn't get all of our parcels every day, but there was enough that we could combine it all and get a meal or two out of that.
I've had a lot of ex-prisoners of war who were held in Germany talk about the bread that the Germans would give you that had a pretty healthy sawdust content, apparently.
It was hard to cut. I don't recall that we experienced any sawdust in it. We may have.
Well, maybe this is a way to put it in perspective. So October 4th, 1944 was your 10th and final mission when you got shot down. How much do you think you weighed approximately then?
Oh, probably 155, something around in there.
And when you finally got liberated, roughly 7 months later, what'd you weigh then?
I have no idea. I'm sure we got weighed, but I don't recall what it was.
But you probably lost a few pounds.
I'm sure we did.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to hear from you. What was the hardest part, the most challenging part of being a prisoner?
Just waiting. Waiting to be liberated without suffering any particular exposition. Well, the guys that were there before me had elected certain officer or something of that nature to be heading up that section of the prison. And one of them, I can't remember his name now, was an American fighter pilot ace. Mm-hmm. He was a well-known ace, so that they had that. But he was in prison camp with us, not in our particular barracks, but he was there.
You said the waiting was the hardest part. Every time I've tried to put myself in a POW's shoes, that uncertainty seems like it could be overwhelming. Not just waiting, but isn't there part of you that wonders, will I ever get out of here? Will I ever make it back to see my family again?
Well, I'm sure that it occurred to all of us, although we all had the confidence that we were going to excel in the overhead in the beginning.
And did your family know that you were there? Were you able to communicate with them?
Well, they were notified that I was a German prisoner. Eventually, I was able to inform them by mail, and I also got mail from them.
I bet being in prison camp and getting a letter from home is a pretty good feeling.
Oh, it definitely is. And for the guys that didn't happen to, well, you had to just buck them up a little bit.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, the idea of bucking up a fellow prisoner, because I'm just guessing there were days where sometimes your hope starts to dwindle a little bit.
No, the war was at a point where I think we had full confidence that we were going to overcome it at some point in the hopefully near future.
I've heard some pretty good stories from prisoners, especially even at your camp, Stalag Luft 1, about finding a way to smuggle in a little contraband or get creative in taking certain supplies and making things out of them, whether it was a crystal set radio they'd hide under the floorboards, or one ex-POW from your camp showed me the ring that he made, and the metal was from the bully beef cans in your Red Cross parcels, and the setting was from his toothbrush. Do you have any memories of things you did to pass the time or ingenuity that cropped up here and there?
I think we spent most of our time playing bridge.
How did the Germans treat you?
We didn't have any contact with them except that the guards would come in every day, and we had to stand up about 9 o'clock in the morning. We had to be there at 9 o'clock in the morning and stand up and be counted. And the rest of the time was particularly ours. When the weather was nice enough, the grounds were big enough so we could play softball out there.
Were you a pretty good hitter?
No. I had played softball in the States, and I never was a very good hitter. I was a pitcher.
Well, and the reason that they would get you up every morning and count you is they want to make sure nobody's escaping. Did you ever contemplate that possibility?
No, because we already had stories internally of people that had tried to escape. And there were stories about two or three of them, I think, that had gotten over to the next German town. Of course, Sweden wasn't involved in the war, and so they could get aboard a Sweden boat sometimes and get back to Sweden and be recovered that way. But in my group, there was never anybody who tried to escape, or nobody that we knew of that had attempted an escape earlier.
And did any other of the members of your crew end up in your camp?
I think they did, but I never knew it. We never got together or anything because we were divided in different sections, and we didn't have the opportunity to get around. Although I think one of my crew had investigated around and found out that I was there, and he came over and talked to me for a little bit about his experiences and my experience.
You know, again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm thinking 7 months after day after day could feel like a long time. What was it that kept you going or gave you hope that you would get out of there someday?
Well, we all had good confidence that we were going to get out of there, of course. Even at that point, we could assume that the Allied armies were going to oversee the Germans.
Don't forget to look up POW MIA Day observances in your area for next weekend, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and part of a pattern that I suppose was inevitable. Last week, we honored a 102-year-old World War II veteran who had just passed away. Today, we're remembering a 103-year-old and a 101-year-old. Our greatest generation is leaving us, but their stories continue to inspire. It wasn't too long ago that I had the privilege of meeting ex-POW Bill Powell in Fort Collins, Colorado, where Brad Hoops and his organization, Remember and Honor, has been capturing veteran stories for many, many years. I asked Bill Powell if rumblings of liberation had reached Stalag Luft I in Barth, Germany.
Yeah, because some of our officers who were our keepers also would get radio communications from the Germans as to what was going on. So they knew what the situation was all through. And then, of course, we knew that the Russians were coming someplace.
That's a story I have read about a little bit and had some veterans, some ex-POWs tell me, and you referenced an ace earlier. I think if my memory is correct, that was a guy named Zemke who then dealt with the leadership of the camp and made sure that you guys didn't get handed over to the Russians. Is that what you remember?
Well, I remember the name Zemke. All of a sudden, everything cleared out, and we found out that the Russians had come over and said, "What the hell were you guys still doing in the camp? Why haven't you liberated yourselves?" But it was too early in the war then. By the time the Russians got there, we didn't have an opportunity to do anything.
Well, tell me about the day that you got to become a free man again and what that felt like.
Well, of course, they took us over to Camp Lucky Strike in France. Then we knew we were free and eventually we'd get to be home. But because there was a shortage of seaborne traffickers, we just had to wait until space became available, because they were liberating all those German camps up there, and that's where the guys were going and eventually going home. So we took advantage of it, two or three of us. We got to visit Paris twice. I decided to use a kind of a trick question. I'd like to get over to England and see my Irish relatives, which I did have Irish relatives. So four of us got together and applied for passage to London, which they gave us in order to get rid of us. So we went over and spent a couple of days in London and a couple of days visiting the outskirts of London, and that was great. And finally they realized what they had to do to get us back, and that was cut off our money.
Party's over, huh?
Right, party's over. So we reported back, the four of us reported back to Southampton, and within a few days, we had a passage home.
What did it mean to you to come back on American soil after everything you've been through?
It was great to come back home. We ported somewhere in Jersey. We were supposed to go into New York, but that was filled up or something. We couldn't get in there, so we got liberated in New Jersey and managed to get train traffic or any other thing that we could. And I was fortunate in my hometown was a New York City main line, so I got aboard the train and came in and got out, sat down at the station and waited for my dad to come and pick me up.
I bet you can still remember the look on his face when he saw you.
Well, he was real happy, and I was happy to see him. Because he had been in service, too, of course, and finally got discharged.
And any time I hear a story like yours, I just have to wonder, you've lived a lot of life since World War II. 80 years since World War II. Did your experience as a POW change the perspective that you brought to the rest of your life since then?
No, I don't think so, except that I had a partial degree in civil engineering. So I hoped, of course, that when I got back, I would be involved in some sort of civil engineering function.
And that's the career you ended up in?
That's correct.
In fact, somebody told me there's a bridge named after you in Florida.
Yeah, that county commission. I was working for the county commission in Miami-Dade County. Back in earlier days, the county had built a causeway from downtown city Miami over to Key Biscayne, which was a large island off the coast and becoming more and more popular every day, particularly after the causeway was down there. They could get simple access, which didn't require a boat. The problem was the causeway had to cross the intercoastal waterway, and any traffic on the intercoastal waterway has the right-of-way. And so if there was traffic on the causeway, they had to stop because there was no bridge or any sort there. Wait for the bridge to open up so the boat traffic could get through. Then that became more of a problem because it held up emergency vehicles, for one thing, if they were coming across the causeway and had to stop for a boat. So after I got out of service, I went to work for Dade County, which I had worked for before. I took over the engineering section. We said, well, the simplest way to do that is to heighten the bridge. The causeway was promoting enough traffic anyhow to provide for widening the causeway at certain points. So we developed a high-level bridge going from the mainland in downtown Miami over to land on the causeway, well beyond the boat traffic that had to go through there. And a high-level bridge, anybody could get, any boat traffic could get through there. In fact, as I had one businessman who I had known before from downtown Miami, and he called me, he said, Bill, how high is that clearance going to be? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll check with the designers. So we had an engineering company designing that portion of the bridge and causeway. They said, oh, it'll be 11 feet. Well, it could be a little more if necessary. So I called the guy back and I told him, well, it's going to be 11 feet. He had a sailboat in the downtown Miami Marina that he used to go out every now and then, and he needed 11 feet, 6 inches in clearance. So I called the designers back and told them, and they said, oh, it's no problem. We'll just add 6 inches. Oh, God.
So if I or anybody listening to this goes down there, they get to go over the Bill Powell Bridge.
That's what it says. Uh-huh. And it came as a complete surprise because, of course, by that time I was back working for Dade County. I always attended county commission meetings, particularly if I had something of consequence that was appearing before them. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden this came up about naming a bridge, Bill Powell Bridge. Well, I thought it was a bridge that had been a bascule bridge that had been across the Miami River just about 4 blocks from where I lived. And it was a bascule bridge because the theory was that they were going to bring some kind of boats up the Miami River to Hialeah, where I lived, unload them and do everything they had to there. So when they named the Bill Powell Bridge, across that portion of the bridge, I mean, I was flabbergasted. I had never heard of anything like that. But they went ahead and did that, and so the other bridge was named for me.
Not too many people can say that. One thought, anytime I talk to someone who's been a prisoner of war, I just have to ask what your perspective on freedom is, because you've had to live in the absence of freedom. What does that mean about how you view the freedom that so many of us take for granted?
I think we all had to recognize one of these days we're going to be free. We're not going to be no prison people all of our lives. We're going to be free somehow, particularly in our situation, because we knew that the war was going to end sometime and we'd be home.
And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and telling us a story that nobody else could tell us. If you look back on 103 years and counting, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I think it's that bridge.
Maybe you'll get to drive over the Bill Powell Bridge someday, and you certainly have a chance to visit the Ray Lee Room at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in Fresno, California. Ray was one of just 20,000 Chinese-American veterans of World War II. In retirement, he helped build and repair countless displays at that wonderful museum. Ray was active right up to his passing at the age of 101. We heard some of his stories just a few months ago on the 80th anniversary of VE Day. But before we're out of time today, I want you to hear about some of his closest calls in Europe in his voice, and then some of what he witnessed at Flossenbürg concentration camp as well.
Well, there's three of us. We're standing out in a little village in a courtyard and was out there chewing the rag. Three of us are standing there. Pretty soon I heard a boom. Incoming mail. Boy, when we heard the incoming boom, we took off. Those three guys and myself, we hit the stairwell and we all got up and started laughing. Pretty soon we heard another boom. So I took off again. I ran around the house and I seen this big old bomb shelter. I was going to jump in there, but I lift up the lid, I looked down there, and there was some German civilian in there. I said, oh, not for me to be jumping in there. So I dropped the old trap door, and I went around the house. I dug me a foxhole from the other side where the shell was coming in. So that was one of my scariest moments.
Well, that's one of the questions that came to mind. What were the scariest things you had to deal with? Because at different times, I mean, you could have bombers going overhead, you could have artillery coming in, mortar fire, machine gun fire, mines. What was the scariest thing for you?
Well, a company commander, he was the one that got orders from the higher-up echelon to tell us where to move. So we moved into this little town, little village-like. And we seen a lot of white sheet hanging out on the window of the doors in the village. And we was out there chewing the rag. Pretty soon I looked up. There was a company of infantry was coming up the road. There were platoon size. They were on each side of the road. And the captain was leading them. And he come up to me and he said, what are you people doing up here? I said, isn't this town taken? He said, hell no. And I said, wow, we're in trouble. So I took off, and he continued his way up forward. That was the closest I ever seen. We took the town without knowing it wasn't taken. Man, I tell you, the OC, the company commander, he really screwed up and almost got us all killed. Good thing this infantry company came out and asked us what the hell we was doing up here.
So you're walking around without a care, not knowing you're in danger and there's enemy all around you.
Yeah, that's true. We heard shots going on, firing going on. We didn't know what was going on until they came up and told us we were not supposed to be up there. And we were up there ahead of the infantry. Boy, I tell you, that was one of the screwiest moments I ever experienced.
And I know some of this stuff is difficult to talk about, and I'm not trying to twist your arm. So if you say you don't want to talk about it, don't. Are there days where you still, in your mind, see or hear or smell something from years ago?
Well, I never forget the smell of death. It's something that you never forget the smell. Body odor, it's one smell you never forget. We had a lot of these cases come up. They were on the wagon. They were all covered with straw. And we were downwind, and then we got put a good whiff of it, and we knew exactly what was going on when we got the smell. They were carrying these civilians. They were all on a big wagon. They were covered with straw. All you see was just feet hanging out, bare feet hanging out, and you never forget. There was quite a few civilian casualties I seen, and the smell was horrific, especially when you're downwind. Well, you know, we hit one town in Germany. Me and my buddy from Missouri, we decided to take a little walk, see this little town. We were stationed in this town, and we came around a little corner, and all of a sudden, there were three or four Jewish POW who were dressed in black and white stripe. They had a yellow patch over the left side of the uniform, and when they seen us, I was shocked. We came head on around this corner, and he grabbed us and tried to hug us, and I was trying to fight him off, tell him, no, I don't want to touch him because they were all contaminated. So me and my buddy was fighting him off, trying to tell him to get away from us. We don't want to get too close to him. So anyhow, I'd never seen them. They were in real bad shape. They were all skins and bone. They were all dressed in a black and white stripe. They had a gold star over the left heart. They invited us over to the concentration camp, so we went along with them, and they gave us some liquor to celebrate the release of them. Well, I didn't take it, but my buddy from Missouri, he took a swig of it, and he said, boy, that stuff is strong. He said, boy, he shook his head. I said, I'm glad I didn't take it. And I said, no, I don't want it, I don't want it. They showed me, they took me in the concentration camp. I seen Polish people, I seen Italian, I seen English, I seen Gypsy, I seen all kind of nationality in this concentration camp. And boy, I said, this is one hell of a place to be. Oh man, that's terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what I wonder. It's not like you've led a privileged life. I mean, you've had to work hard. You grew up without your mother. You heard your grandmother's story of immigrating from China to be a laborer here in America. But to see that kind of suffering, to see people in that kind of physical shape, how much of a jolt was that to you? How did that affect you?
Boy, it was a shock, complete shock. I'd never seen anything like this before in my life. This was an eye-opener. It really showed me how people were treated. I'd never seen people like that in that shape, and they were really bad shape. And one time we had brought one Jewish casualty into the aid station. He was covered with feces. He smelled so bad we couldn't get near him. And he was all caked up on his body, and his whole face, everything was caked up with feces. And he told us, we had a couple of Jewish GI in our outfit. We had to call one of them in and have him interpret what this guy was telling us. And he said there were 30 of them to begin with, and he's the only one left. They had him in this pen. The feces all over the place. He was laying in there for almost a month. And we brought him in. We couldn't get close to him. He smelled so bad. You know, it was really bad. The other 30 passed away. They died. He was the only survivor. He was the only one left. He was in bad shape.
Is there anything else from those months that you spent in Europe with the 97th Infantry Division that stands out to you today that you think the rest of us ought to know?
Well, I put in 3 years and 3 days with the service, and I learned a lot. Learned how to control myself, how to take care of people, and how to respect people and stuff like that. It makes you grow up faster, become independent, and you can take care of yourself. You know how to greet people and mix with people, things like that. It helps. You know, being in a service, you learn a lot.
Ray Lee, one of America's last Chinese-American veterans of World War II, has passed away at the age of 101. And let's finish now with what Ray said when I asked what advice he had for young people today.
Live a clean life. Work hard. Make yourself known to people that you're well-behaved, well-mannered kid, and be kind and nice to other people. Help them out. That's what we were taught when we were kids.
Sounds like a pretty good approach for all of us to employ in 2025 as well. Bill Powell and Ray Lee, two World War II veterans who saw and experienced things most of us might never even imagine. Their long and fruitful lives, an example for us to follow, and their memories, a reminder of those four words we conclude with each week on Hometown Heroes.
freedom is not free.